Hey everybody, Brian here with Canines on Duty and another Canine Mind Freak episode. In today's episode, I went ahead and extracted the audio from a video interview that I did with Daryl Gaunt with Paraclete Canine. And for those of you that aren't aware, our video blog was actually named Canine Cop Shop Talk, and we have now transitioned over to Canine Mind Freak. So I went ahead and cut that out, and we just dive right into the interview. The sound quality isn't the greatest, but we've got some new equipment recently, which is helping us out with the sound. Unfortunately, we didn't have that, so it's a little tingy, but the content is absolutely amazing. I think you're going to love this podcast. So here we go. Let's dive into this.
Today, I have Daryl Gaunt with me with Paraclete Canine. And Daryl, you've been in business with Paraclete for 5 years, correct?
Yes, sir.
5 years. And I got to mention that you are presently an active LEO canine handler.
Yes, sir, for Los Angeles County Sheriffs.
Bingo, Los Angeles, LA. So, man, you guys get deployed a lot.
Yes, we do. We average around 600 deployments a year. 300 SWAT deployments. So yeah, we're a little busy.
Yeah, I bet you are. Well, heavily populated area, lots of crime. So yeah, I'm sure you guys keep popping. So to give our viewers a little bit about your history, and then I'm going to let you go a little bit deeper with that. But Daryl's been training canines for 41 years, started when he was 14 years old.
Kidding, right? You're killing me. Oh.
The numbers, and that's when you're like, oh my God, where'd the time go?
It has been that long. Yeah.
Yep. And then you spent some time in the Army as a handler as well.
Yes, sir.
So in other words, you have 41 years of solid experience on a very professional level, both in the Army and with the LA County Sheriff's Department.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
So I really like to talk to people with a background like yours, because I think together we can shed some light on some myths.
Hopefully, yes.
What we're going to get into, but first, I'd like you to give us a little background on how all this came to be. Like what got you from 14 to here? So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So my dad was one of the original canine handlers for Inglewood PD. And Inglewood, if you don't know, is in Southern California here. When you fly into LAX, the area you fly into, that South Central area, is Inglewood. So it was a very high crime area. And there were only four handlers at the time. The dogs that they used to have, that was 78. So the dogs we used to get weren't the nice social stable dogs we have now. No, they were idiots. And my dad, I was 14, and he goes, hey, I need someone to be a bite dummy. So here's what we call a puppy sleeve now. It wasn't a full bite suit or a hard sleeve. They gave me a puppy sleeve. And I said, stick this on your arm and go out in the corporate yard somewhere and find somewhere to hide. So being 14 years old and being the smartest man on the planet, because I'm a 14-year-old male, I hide under a bus flat. Yeah, it was a great spot to hide for a dog.
Yeah.
So I got bit in the behind, let's say, for my first bite. Yeah, so it was awesome. Taught me to be a really skilled decoy.
Yeah.
Fast forward through that, I decoyed for them for a number of years. I joined the LA Shoots and Club that my dad was the founder of. And I did the training director there for a while on an apprenticeship, did a lot of their helper work for another 4 years until I was 18 and went in the Army. I did 10 years in the Army. Five of it was as a canine handler. I was an MP, military policeman. 5 years of that as a canine handler overseas in Germany. Got out from that in 91 and went directly to the Sheriff's Department. Been there for 30 years. Worked the jails, worked South Central LA for 7 years down in Century Station, and then got to the canine unit. So our department's a little different than most departments. It takes 10 to 12 years on the department before we're even considered for canine.
Wow.
When you go to canine, you actually go to the SWAT side first. Mm-hmm. You get all your qualifications on the SWAT side. They give you the thumbs up or the thumbs down after 6 months on the team. And if you get the thumbs up, hopefully, then you come to the canine side to me. I go get you a dog. We train you up on the dog side. So all of our canine handlers are SWAT guys first. No. Then you become a canine handler.
That's interesting.
For my department, we have 12 full-time dogs for patrol. All of our dogs are SWAT qualified. They're all on SWAT side. And then we supplement patrol for whatever requirements they have.
Okay.
About 10 years ago, I was hired by Alahorse International, which is the main vendor here for the West Coast that we get our dogs from. Dave Reaver, if anybody knows Dave, and now his son Mike took over the business. And I've been an instructor out there for 10 years also. So then 5 years ago, well, I'm sorry, let me back up. About 8-9 years ago, I started a tactical canine course for the LA County Sheriffs. We run it twice a year. We only limit to 8 dogs. So there was about a 3-year waiting list. So a lot of my buddies were like, hey, I can't get in your school. I can't get in the class. What the hell? Hey, can you come out and just teach us on the side? So I started doing that 6-7 years ago. Yeah, I'll come out, and they were paying me in beer and pizza and, you know, Starbucks cards and all kinds of crap because I was just doing it as a favor for these guys. So pretty soon my wife got tired of having beer and pizza stocked up in the garage and says, hey, you gotta figure another way to do this. So I had to start the business. Mm-hmm. The idea originally was I was going to retire, which is coming up soon. I was going to retire and start the business. Well, I had to start a little bit early. Mm-hmm. And once I started it, it kind of exploded on me and got out of hand. And I've had to put a cap on it because I was still working full-time as a deputy.
Right.
And at Alahorse. So I was juggling 3 different things. So now I'm getting ready to pull the plug on the sheriff's department. I've hit my 30 years and I'm getting ready to do the Paraclete Canine full-time. So,
well, that's good.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, at least you can jump start on that, though. I mean, being too busy is a good problem to have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I never complain. God's good to me. He always puts enough work in that I can't get in too much trouble at home.
Yeah, that's good.
After about 2 days, my wife starts looking at my watch and going, hey, don't you have somewhere you need to be? Yes, dear, I do. Yeah, I'll go somewhere. So. That's why I had to just buy that big camper that I was telling you about. It's now my mobile command post for Paraclete Canine.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it gives your wife a break.
Yes, that's the most important part.
Yeah. Okay, so let's dive into this topic of discussion. And Daryl and I, we've had a time to chat prior to shooting the video, and we decided that something that he's very passionate about is obedience and having control of your canine. Now, there's a lot of misconceptions out there that obedience training is going to ruin other aspects of the job. And I argue from a scientific standpoint, specifically a psychological standpoint, that obedience is behavioral rehabilitation.
Yes.
So what Daryl is proposing and that he has been proposing for so many years is that obedience is about controlling the behaviors of the dog, which means when it matters, the dog is subconsciously programmed to comply with the handler. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, yes. Spot on.
So then, as we talked about on the phone, our behaviors come from our beliefs about a situation. So if a dog believes that the handler is in control of a scenario or a situation, then they behave in a way that supports what the handler or the trainer has been repeating, because we program that subconscious mind through the repetition. So I think what we want to hear from you, now that we've established that obedience is behavioral modification, what's your top technique to begin to gain control or to gain control of the behaviors of the dog?
That's simple. It's consistency. All my handlers lack consistency. I get calls all the time. Hey, I got this problem. Oh, my dog's doing this. My dog's doing that. You don't have a dog problem. You have what I call a monkey problem. So my handlers are monkeys. The guys holding the leash are just monkeys holding dogs. They're dog chauffeurs. The reason we use the dogs is because they have an innate ability to do the job we ask them to do. All we have to do is kind of shape that and get them to the right place and let them do what they're supposed to do.
Right.
The problem is our handlers get too involved in it and they're overusing their monkey brain.
Right.
Which is my problem. So consistency is my biggest pet peeve. All my guys that train with me always laugh because one of my favorite sayings is there must be an echo in this place because I know you didn't tell that dog to do something twice.
Right.
If you tell the dog sit, he gets one chance at it. Dogs are black and white animals. Excuse me. They believe that they're either pregnant or not. There's no gray area. It's not half pregnant. It's not anything. If I say sit and you hover above a sit and your ass isn't on the ground, that's disobedience and you will be corrected for it. And if you're consistent with it, with the little things, when you send that dog on a suspect and 5 feet before he gets to him, the guy gives up and you yell here, it's just like sit. You're pregnant or not. I'm telling you to come back and there's consequences if you don't. We search 99% of our searches are off leash. We're a find and bite agency. We have a lot of deployments and we have to have a lot of control over our dogs. That's where this whole thing came, especially like my e-collar class. People think it's all about an e-collar class and it's not. It's actually a behavior shaping class. That's why it's right. Called behavior shaping. Using an e-collar, and I give you about 7 other tools, including a leash, a choke chain, the tip of your boot, a rock you pick up, anything you can use humanely to correct the dog. All my training is based on pack mentality and pack belief. Mm-hmm. How would the dog react in a pack? Because a dog is a pack animal. They believe we're in a pack environment. They don't think, oh, I became a police canine. Now I'm living in a policeman's house. I'm doing a police job. No, it's just a different job in the pack. And that's how I always break things down to make guys understand. If you have consistency, you're honest with the dog, and you ask him to do the things that you know he already can do, then you'll get those performances at a higher level.
Right. Now, one of the—
If I expand a little bit, but—
No, that's great.
You got to reel me in sometimes, get me back in line.
Well, honestly, that was really good information. A couple of things that I want to clarify from a science standpoint. One, I know because of our prior conversation that when you use the term pack or pack environment, that I know you know what it means. But I want to break this down for people that might read into this too much, because it's about association. Yeah. And I've questioned handlers that bring up the whole pack thing. And I said, okay, but humans are pack animals too. The problem with using the pack mentality is that the human brain goes to wolf because we associate pack with wolf. But science tells us, specifically John Roach with the National Geographic News, states that our domesticated dogs originated from the Eurasian gray wolf about 16,500 years ago. That's a long time to be socializing with humans and not socializing with a wolf.
Absolutely.
There's a major definitive difference that if you hear somebody use the word pack mentality, they're actually talking about social mentality.
Domesticated animals, yes.
Right. But because they're a dog and they came from wolf, we still stick to the term pack mentality. But for the undereducated people, they think that I could be— wolves are really harsh on each other. That's true. Yes. That's where the whole grabbing the scruff and pinning them to the ground comes from. But does that technique really work for domestic dog? In my opinion, and based on the evidence, no, because they don't understand that. Now, if it's a safety issue, yeah, I'm going to hold that dog down so I don't get bit and go to the hospital because I got a job to
right.
do. But as far as doing like the alpha role, the reason why that's become outdated is because the science has proved that it actually, with a domestic dog, because they don't understand that language, they can easily interpret that in a way that we don't intend for them to interpret.
Right.
So I just wanted to touch on that real quick, that an experienced trainer like you and the others, when they talk about pack, they instantly know it's not— we're not talking about wolves. We're just saying that for this animal, we're creating a social environment.
Exactly. It's how he was raised. It was how his yes. parents were raised. It was how the domesticated dog 40 years ago was raised and how they've interacted with us and what is accepted norm and not accepted. Right. You can't take the domesticated dog and put him back into a wolf pack and expect him to survive. He's going to be like, what is this? I don't understand. And he's going to get killed. Right. Because, like you said, they're very harsh on each other. Where domesticated dogs aren't the same type of animal in the wild. That's why when people try to pull wolf hybrids out after one generation, they're like, oh, no, he's fine. No, he's not fine.
Right.
He's still a wolf. When push comes to shove, you will become a wolf. A domesticated dog won't. A domesticated dog will fall back to his innate behaviors that he's been bred into for the thousands of years. So yeah, we agree with that. And yeah, that alpha role just kills me when guys alpha role. Relax. Like I said, other than safety, yes. Right. That's when people say, I've got an alpha dog. Really? How was the fight this morning? Yeah. And they're like, what do you mean? Well, if you have a true alpha dog that you're talking about in a pack mentality, in the wolf pack, he's going to fight you every single time he meets you for that role.
Yep.
And they go, oh, yeah. No, you've got a beta dog. You may have a good, strong beta dog, but you do not have an alpha unless you're fighting him every morning.
You know, and that kills me too, by the way. That's an excellent topic you just brought up, because I have people all the time that go to the trainers and you know, more or less that we're talking about civilians and pet dog owners, but I get it, the occasional handlers too. They're like, shoot, I just lost my train of thought. What were we just talking about? The
alpha and...
Yeah, I'm sorry, the alpha, yeah.
It's okay.
My brain was going, trying to focus on too many different things at once. Yes, alpha. They'll say, my dog is alpha over the car.
Oh, yeah.
No, because or the couch, or my dog is alpha over the front door. No, because the definition of alpha is total control.
Absolutely, total. Yes, yeah.
And that's what you said right there that was so profound to me, and hearing that from another trainer that gets it. Because you're right. You would constantly be fighting with a true alpha dog.
Yeah.
So I think the term gets overused. The dog is not being alpha. And you picked the great terminology for that. Your dog is beta. It may be a strong beta.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely. So, okay, the other thing that I do want to talk to you about is this. You had mentioned, we talked about correction, and you talked about different things, the tip of a boot or the e-collar or whatnot. And I wanted to get your opinion. About a decade ago, I created a definition of correction. So okay. It's different than what you'll read in the dictionary, and not too many, anybody that goes to my psychology class, they'll hear this. But... And then I want to take a moment to explain and then get your insight and how you've experienced this exact same thing. Because I already know you're
going to make my head hurt again, right, Brian? You're going to keep it simple. Remember, I'm a cop.
Okay, so my definition of a correction is this. A correction is a stimulus greater than the stimulus the dog is focused on. So let me say that again.
I'm following you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So think about it. And scientifically, this is what we know. The thalamus, which I've talked about in a lot of my videos, is like the old school operator. It has to determine, okay, you want me to send you where, and then we plug it in, you know, the old school switchboards.
Right.
That's what the thalamus does. So that's where we get auditory exclusion. That's where we get the dog zoned in and focused, because the thalamus, its job is to determine where to send information to. The concept of dog training is that we have to create a punisher, which can be painful. I like to think of it differently. A correction is about bringing the dog's focus back on you as the handler, which means there are levels that I need to go to. If the dog simply smells a cat, I might be able to use the vibrate on an e-collar because the focus is only here. But then the dog sees the cat. Now his focus goes up because he's starting to tap into that prey drive. The
vibrate is not going to work. I agree.
The thalamus focuses on what's most important, and the lesser correction is not going to interrupt the brain to pull the thalamus off of what it's focused on.
Right.
And then if the dog engages in the chase, well, now that's through the roof, even whatever setting you are on in the mid-range isn't going to work when it's up here. So there's these different levels. But I think that most people and handlers think it's about pain.
Right.
It's not. The dog is exhibiting a behavior because of what it's paying attention to. And our goal as trainers is to bring the attention back to us.
Now, can I ask you one thing about that?
Go for it. Yeah.
So And the reason why I double clutched when you first said it is, and this is the way I teach with the e-call and everything else, is as the stimulation level goes up, you see a bite two come out on the field. Stimulation went up a whole lot. A minute ago, I was just playing with your toy in front of you. Now the stimulation went up because now the big toy's out on the field. So your titration, or what I call my titration, is the level of electrical stimulation or correction or whatever you're using has to go up also. Now, at one point, the dog understands through consistency, every time I don't listen to you, no matter what this is out here, this distraction is out here, I'm going to get a correction. I can lower those correction levels back down. So when you first said it, I was like, well, the correction doesn't always have to be over the top of a female in heat.
Yeah.
One of the biggest things I tell guys, and I explain it, the reason for an e-collar is if I send a dog in the backyard and I've got a suspect on one side with a gun and a female in heat on the other side of the yard, what makes the dog go towards the guy with the gun as opposed to female in heat? Because that's the biggest attraction. We've all been in a bar at, you know, 19, 20 years old. We all know the female in heat is going to attract the dog.
That's right.
What keeps the dog from going to her first and go take care of the bad guy? And then after, then he can run over to the female and go, hey, did you see what I did over there? Yeah, hey, how you doing? So the idea is the dog knows there's going to be a correction if you don't do it. Now, I don't have to hit him at a 127 on a dog truck just when he goes in the backyard, because through consistency, repetition, association, and training, I've hit him at, say, a 20 or a 30 when he's even thought about going out the wrong way and kept him in line. So now he knows that 127 is hanging out there, but I don't have to hit him with it. I can hit, if he starts veering towards the female in heat, I can hit it on a 15 or 20. He goes, whoa, whoa, okay, hey, we're better than that. I'm good, I'm good. And then goes back into his job. Is that following along? Okay.
Yeah, right. Because in the beginning, it's going to be higher because the dog is so focused, but as he learns, so this does get into operant conditioning. I just feel like there's too many people that are creating bad experiences for the dog because their mindset says if the dog disobeys, it's rebellious. It's being rebellious. So therefore, I need to punish this dog so he learns his lesson.
Right.
The question is, are we actually dealing with rebellion or is it natural instincts in the dog? You follow me?
Yeah, or improper training through repetition association that you've allowed them to get away, and now they're doing what you've allowed them to do, but you don't realize it, and you think they're being disobedient to you when you've allowed it to happen before.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Okay.
And so you may be at a higher level to interrupt the brain, but with repetition and the key word that you use, consistency, the dog makes that association, and that's where it trickles into operant conditioning. That it's an unpleasant stimulus, but I guess the whole point in bringing this up, which you've brought up some really good topics within the idea of correction, I'm looking to rechange the thoughts of or in handlers about correction. Is correction something that should be extremely painful all the time? The answer is no, because the mission is not to create a painful, overly aversive condition. It's about bringing the dog's attention back to you.
Right.
I just think there's so many different methodologies. There's so many different ways of training a dog. That's something we talked about before I hit record on the video.
Right.
People tend to harness the belief about what a correction actually is or what obedience actually is. You know how many people I talk to that don't understand that obedience training is behavioral rehabilitation? It is behavior modification.
Absolutely.
So they don't understand that. And so that's why I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Well, I've got a better one for you. I've got trainers that I ask, how often do you do obedience? Oh, two or three times a week. I go, no, you actually do obedience every single contact you have with your dog.
Yep.
Every time. You're doing some type of obedience. It may not be a regimented routine, but if you walk outside and your dog jumps on you and you knock him down and tell him to stop it or tell him to stay when you shut the gate, you're doing obedience.
Right.
If you let him get away with it a little bit here and a little bit there, it's like the kid. And I think of it like a five-year-old kid. If you let them get away with an inch here, an inch there, before you know it, they're running amok, running down the hallway with scissors and a lighter lit, you know, because you let these little things slide. And in the dog's mind, they believe, wait a minute, you didn't correct me on that one, so I'm allowed to do that now. And then you correct them 3 days later for it, and it's not fair to the dog, number one. So you create conflict between you and the dog. Number two, you're shaving off a little bit of that trust each time, I believe. And number three is the dog doesn't trust you. When you say, do this in a really, really high speed situation, the dog's like, no, I don't think I'm going to listen to you. Because in my belief, and this is what I teach, even the bite command is an obedience routine. It's not a release. Everyone thinks, oh, I'm free to go. No, I'm telling you, go bite that guy right there and hold on to him. That's an obedience. Now, it's a fun obedience for them. They love it, obviously. But it's an obedience, just like a release. People, when they come to the my classes, they go, I'm having a problem with my out. You know, he won't let go of the toy. I go, he's going to let go of the toy. And in about 10 seconds, I've got the dog letting go of the toy. Now, like you said, that's because I'm going to drop the hammer on him, and I'm very black and white with him. Yeah. Me coming with no baggage to this dog, and I never, 90% of the time, the dogs are either off leash or I'm within their kill zone. I don't believe in this crap of behind a fence and smacking the dog with a stick or hitting them with an e-collar when they can't get to me. I'm honest with the dog. When I correct the dog, he knows why he's being corrected. He knows it's a fair correction. And if I overcorrect him, he knows he can come back to me and say, no, that was unfair. I didn't like that. And in our dog's world, it's either fight or flight. And our dogs, hopefully, if we got the right dog, aren't going to run away. They're going to turn around and bite you.
Right.
And that's the honesty I have with the dogs. Like I said, I hate correcting muzzled dogs, although sometimes we have to because they're in a muzzled situation.
Right.
But when I'm training my dogs, most of the time, they're off leash. They're sitting next to the handler. I go, okay, two announcements, send the dog to search. They'll start their announcements and the dog will yell, you know, yelp or bark or something. And I have a stick and I'm standing next to the handler and I don't even really know this dog. And I'll yell fooey and smack the dog with a stick one time.
Right.
And the dog looks at me and goes, hey, you do know I'm off leash, right? Yeah. You know I'm not muzzled? Yeah. Okay, just check it. And then he goes back into his surveillance position because it's a fair correction. Right. He knew he was being disobedient. He did something he wasn't supposed to do that he knows isn't in the norm. And he accepted the correction and then was quiet. And after he was quiet, he got his reward of being released. And that's my belief.
Yeah.
I'm very honest with the dogs in that way.
Yeah, and I think that that's a really good mindset to have. And the reason why I appreciate what you're saying is because in the last 3 to 5 years, I don't have the case study in front of me. There's actually many case studies, but the question was posed, can dogs infer or can they have inferences? Meaning, can they reason and rationalize a situation? And what we found scientifically is, yes, they can. So what you're saying is you're creating this ability for the dog to make sense and to rationalize with you rather than just, you're a jerk, I'm going to eat you, done deal.
Yeah. It goes back to the socialization concept model of, like we were talking about the pack. Yeah. That's what they've understood.
That's right.
You know, it's interaction. A lot of my handlers, I want to punch them in the throat sometimes. They go, don't touch my dog. Don't praise my dog. Don't correct my dog. Don't do that. What are you talking about, dummy?
Yeah.
If I've got backup officers, they're part of the pack. They should be allowed to correct or reward my dog, my belief.
Yep.
Because if they aren't allowed that, and they make a mistake and step on the dog's paw or something else, and the dog realizes, guess what? You aren't allowed to correct me or reward me, so that means I'm over you. So I get to correct you if you do something. That's our mentality.
So do you believe that's the leading cause of fellow officers getting attacked by a police canine?
No, the leading cause is stupid monkeys not having a proper sight picture when they release the dog. They're focused on threat and not dog. If you look down at your dog before you let go of that leash or that collar, the dog can't lie to you. If the dog's looking at your backup, instead of the guy running down the street, because your backup's closer and screaming and yelling, he's the only, you know, active person he can see. And you let the dog go while you're looking at the suspect down the street, and the dog goes over and grabs your partner, that's your fault.
Yeah.
If I've got a perfect example for you, we were set up in a SWAT configuration. So we had armor on both sides of the vehicle, and the canine handler was watching the suspect and he wasn't watching his dog. And the thing I tell him, before you let go of that missile, double check where he's looking.
Yeah.
Well, around the back of one of the pieces of armor was one of our paramedics who was bored because it's a SWAT thing and he doesn't have anything to do right now. So he kept looking around the corner of the armor. And looking around the corner of the armor. Well, every time he looked around the corner, the dog saw him playing peekaboo behind this armor for like an hour. So the dog was so locked into him. Yep. This guy could have had a bite suit in the car, and this dog was like absolutely stuck on him. So when the SWAT team said, okay, they threw the flashbang, the guy became active. They went to send the dog. He let go of the dog. Dog ran right by the suspect, ran behind the ARV, and bit my paramedic.
Wow.
So, and that's the thing I always say, you know, dogs see pictures. That's what they see. So if you give the right picture, it's like when I see these guys, sometimes they're decoying for dogs in uniform with a bite sleeve in uniform. Mm-hmm. And I about lose my mind. I about start screaming and yelling like, what are you thinking? What are you're teaching the dog to bite guys in uniform. Don't do that.
Right.
Same thing when guys are doing muzzle fights and they've got like exterior vests, like the old flak vests and stuff on. We used to do that. And, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, that's awesome because none of the cops wore exterior vests. We didn't have that many SWAT, you know, guys running around mm-hmm. with dogs. Nowadays, everybody's wearing an external vest. So those vests look just like a tactical guy. Right. So if you're protecting your ribs with a vest on the outside of your clothes, all you're doing is teaching your dog, oh, it's okay to bite the guy in the exterior vest. So I always tell guys, put a sweatshirt, put some over that. Dogs are visual animals. They see pictures. If they've seen the picture before, I've got 1,000 stories, but I'll give you just one. We had a really, really seasoned street dog. Been on the streets 4 or 5 years. He was a stud. We're at a burglary call. Open door, alarm. We make our announcements. We send the dog in. And it's a really big building, and it's where our internal affairs works, where the Office of Independent Review, which are the attorneys that we pay six figures to tell us how screwed up we are. Yeah, those guys. Yeah, they're housed there every way. It's like 7:38 at night. Open door, alarm. We're like, okay, make our loud announcements because this is a righteous building. Send the dog in to search. As we're moving through the building, dog searches, goes around the corner, and all, like I said, all of our searches, 99% are off leash. Mm-hmm. So the dog's roaming. Goes around the corner, out of sight for about 30 seconds, which is our rule. Hey, call that dog back so we can see where he's at. Then we hear, hey, whose dog is this? In a calm manner, not like a suspect, not like someone surprised, like, hey, who brought the dog to work? Here. We get the dog back to us. We move, and here comes this guy in a three-piece suit, you know, with his jacket off. Hey, guys, what's going on? You guys doing some training in here? Yes, sir. That's what we're doing. Who are you and why are you here? Turns out he was one of the attorneys for the Office of Independent Review that tells us how bad we're screwing shit up.
Yeah.
And we're like, did the dog come in? So we debriefed him. He's like, it turns out he's the one that set off the alarm, and it was a false alarm, but thank God our dog didn't bite this guy. So we go, hey, what happened? What was going on? He goes, yeah, I'm sitting at my desk. I'm writing. I'm doing some reports. Dog comes in, came around the back of the chair, looked under the desk, like looking for a guy hiding, walked back out, looked at me, and went down the hallway. And that's when I called, hey, whose dog is this?
No way.
Like, holy crap. Well, we went back to our shop. We broke it down. We hot washed it. The dog had never seen just the guy sitting there on the phone. Passive. He'd never seen the guy just sitting at a desk. He'd always seen the guy pulled up in a corner hiding. So that was the picture he was looking for.
Right.
It's just like every once in a while you go to trainings and you'll see the old scenario of the janitor pushing the broom down the hallway. Have you ever seen that one? And dogs
yep.
run right by him.
Yep.
You know, I've had a suspect in the backyard. Airships overhead going, yeah, your suspect's in the backyard. Okay, we send the dog. He picks up a garden hose and starts watering the flowers. And dogs haven't seen that picture before, we'll bypass that guy. They're yeah. looking for the guy in the shed hiding in the corner.
Yeah.
So dogs are picture animals, so it's super important for me to make the dog understand that. So we went back and we taught our dogs. Now, thank God that worked out really well for us because the guy's like, wow, you guys got great dogs. And the next the next independent review study, they're like, oh, those canine guys are great. They're always training, and man, those dogs are under control. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Right.
We went back to our shop and we started teaching the dogs, even passive man just standing there, mm-hmm. you know, sitting there talking on a phone. It's one of my favorite exercises. Two guys playing cards mm-hmm. in a room, send the dog in on a bite command, hit, and you'll be surprised how many dogs will run around the table three times, look at everybody, and run back out.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing about that, a really good story, I'm glad you brought that up, because when I was writing my research paper on, of course, dogs and the belief system of dogs and all that other stuff, and humans and how our belief has a negative effect on dogs at times, I was interviewing Dr. Voss from Purdue. And we were talking about this, and he said, well, we only learn through what we call embodied cognitions, experiences.
God, Brian, here you go again. Mungo hard.
Well, he broke it down. What he said, okay. For example, if I'm trying to tell you what true love is all about and you've never been in love, you can't possibly understand what I'm talking about. You have to have the experience of it for your brain to make sense of that information.
Right.
And that's exactly what you're talking about. The dog has not had an embodied cognition or an experience to tell him what the rules are within those experiences.
Yes.
Which is why so many handlers or even some trainers are failing, because they're not creating all the possibilities, or the trainer is not educating their handlers that, listen, if your dog fails, don't get pissed. That is an opportunity for you to learn and then to recreate where the dog failed and then modify the dog's behavior within that situation.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. No, we train. So we always talk about we train to a level of 10 and only deploy to a level of 5, and we always look like stars.
Yep.
We do what's called from the military, it's the CQB dance. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's the dog can run between a bunch of different operators in different rooms, and as he comes in, he recognizes an operator. Operator tells him, keep searching that way. So it's almost like a game of tag. Right. And I brought that back to my shop, and some of the guys were like, well, we really don't get in that environment. We don't, you know, we don't deploy like that, like the military guys, you know, with 5 different operating groups and 6 different rooms all, you know, moving at the same time. I go, no, but we do search with the dogs off leash and can have 2 suspects all of a sudden engage us in a running gun battle with a loose dog somewhere in this warehouse. Wouldn't you like to be able to be confident that if the dog comes around the corner and you're shooting, he's going to run up to you and go, hey, what's up, Daryl? Yep, revere, bud. Or off. Stay right there, because I'm not your handler, but you know I'm part of your group that can tell you. Same thing we do in day one of the SWAT school is we will muzzle up the dog. And guys always ask, because we're in really tight, confined quarters, usually with NVGs and dark situations, dogs running loose. And guys ask, hey, how do you not get operator's bit? Mm-hmm. Day one, first exercise is we muzzle the dogs up and we put a group of operators in a really tight, like cluster with the dog in the middle. And we start manipulating and harassing the dog and stepping on him and pushing him until he gets pissed off enough to where he muzzle punches one of us.
Right.
If he muzzle punches one of us, the handler doesn't correct him. The entire group collapses on him and corrects him. You know, not the atomic elbow from the top rope. But just a simple, you know, tapping him 4 or 5 times, yelling, booey, on his shoulders. And he goes, what the was that?
Yeah.
Pardon me. Yeah. Sorry, sirs. And then he goes, wait a minute. Every single one of you just corrected me for doing that, which puts me where? Down here. Mm-hmm. So if I run in a room and I see Daryl and he's got a guy at gunpoint, he's screaming and yelling at him, I'm not worried about Daryl. Daryl's part of my group. I got to worry about what Daryl's dealing with. And that's how we teach the dog. It only takes 1 or 2 evolutions before it switches on in that dog's head, because it's what they normally understand in their socialized behavior of,
right.
Dude, this is what I'm telling you. Are you picking up what I'm laying down? And they pick it up right away, and it's ingrained.
Yeah.
And it's worked for us. Like I said, it's not the only way. It's not even the right way. But it's my way until I can steal someone else's idea and make money off of it.
Yeah, well,
no, it works for us.
that's my concept too, though. If don't try to fix what's not broken. If it's working, keep doing it then. Yep. And that's why, you know, I run into a lot of controversy because I'm bringing the science to different techniques. And because it offends people's egos, they just shut it out. Like, no, not at all. I'm not even going to think that way. But you have to look at what's happening psychologically in the brain. If you're talking in a way that the other multicellular organism does not understand, then what good are you doing?
Right.
You know,
right.
So if it's working, it means that they're understanding. You might not know all the science, but that's fine because it's working. Keep doing it.
Dude, it's hilarious that you say that because in my lecture, when I get to operant conditioning, underneath of it in princes, I have scientific voodoo. Because us knuckle draggers think that's some black art magic stuff that, you know, sleight of hand, but it's not. It's just what you guys know and you can explain, but I can't explain it. Right. But I can show you how to do it.
Right.
But it's hilarious that you say it like that.
Yeah. No, I think that's important. Hey, real quick, I do want to, you might know this, but maybe you don't. Going back to other officers getting bit by the dog.
Okay.
There is a physiological reason also why that happens.
Yes.
Scientist Dr. Stanley Coren from the UK, he states in many of his research articles that a dog's visual acuity is only 20/75.
Okay.
So a dog's vision is actually very blurry.
Okay.
But their brain is designed by nature. The instinct is to pick up movement.
Yes.
Even though their world is blurry, they pick up on movement very quickly.
So absolutely.
In fact, he says that objects that a dog can barely see at 20 feet, humans can see at distances of 75 feet.
I'll agree with that 100%. That's why we use flashbangs or other methods to make a suspect move so the dog can get a lock on what I call missile lock.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we deploy our dog, which is why you said the magic words. You tell your handlers that you train, you better pay attention to where the dog is looking, because going back to your story with the paramedic, there was movement that caught the dog's eye.
Absolutely.
This, it trips people out when I say, have you ever seen a dog tree a squirrel? And the squirrel's running around, so the dog's running around, but then all of a sudden the squirrel freezes and the dog keeps running around looking for it.
Yeah.
And literally sometimes only 4 feet away.
Yeah.
Why is the dog then not zoning in? Because the movement stopped. The squirrel is blending in with the color of the tree and there's no movement. Or when you throw a ball and the ball is still in the grass and the dog's standing 4 or 5 feet and they're like, okay, where'd it go? I know it's here somewhere.
Right.
Like if it stopped bouncing behind the dog and they turn around, why can't they see it? Well, they don't see color the way that we do and their vision is very blurry.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
So I think that happened to my brother. My brother was just out of his FTO. I think I may be not telling the story right, but he was chasing a suspect on foot. He didn't hear the announcement that they're releasing the canine. He kept in pursuit. They released the dog and the dog went after him rather than the suspect.
Yeah.
It was only 30 yards in front of him.
Yeah.
Why? Because the dog couldn't tell that he was wearing a uniform at that distance.
Yeah. And I teach a lot of my guys, because normally there's one or two guys that are running or they hit a different angle. So you're releasing the dog behind other people. I always tell them in your briefings every day, pounding these guys' head, if you hear hold for the dog or hold for canine, that means freeze right where you're at.
Yep.
Because the dog is getting released. Because I've had guys running right in front of the dog, suspects in front of them, and the guy will stop, and the dog goes right by my backup officer and goes tags my suspect.
Yeah.
Because they've been told, hold for canine. And I tell the guys, try not to let the dog go. The dog's going to beat him. Unless this is Jesse Owens' track star, the dog's going to beat him. It's just he's going to be a little more tired when he gets bit, which is fine with me.
Right.
So that extra 2 or 3 seconds to yell, hold for canine, let the backup officer stop running. Now the dog reacquires the other rabbit that's running. Right. Now release him. But it all is the monkey using this.
That's right.
So that's where I believe 90% of our problems. And it's also guys that are I'll tell guys on my tactical teams, I go, hey, who's afraid of a dog? and no one raised their hand. I go, y'all are a bunch of liars, which they're SWAT guys. So, you know, if it's not hair product or bicep curls, you know, they aren't interested in it. What? I'm a SWAT guy. I can say that. I'm honest. So I tell the guys, I go, you've got to be honest with me. If you're afraid of the dog, let me know. And those guys are the ones that I pull out first in class, and I make them put the dog on the bite and take the dog off, put the dog on the bite. So they get comfortable with the fact of, okay, this isn't, you know, this ferocious beast.
Right.
You're sitting on a corner with your rifle up, and the dog comes on behind you, and you go, and you move like this. I'm like, dude, that's what the way we teach our decoys to take a bite.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Hold. Don't give any movement. If the dog bumps into you, just let him go by you, because that movement is what's going to key him in. And dogs are self-serving, lazy animals. They're opportunists. And you'll be wearing a 65-pound fur coat if you do something stupid like this as a dog comes by you. And I tell the guys that. I go, you can't blame the dog, because you gave him the picture that he's seen 1,000 times.
Right.
Another reason why in my e-collar class, I teach the dog to bite on command, not movement. I get away from this, you know, whole, the helper gets to make the dog decide. No, 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 no. The dog's been taught for the entire life, for 18 months or however long they've been trained, that when the helper moves like that, you're allowed to bite.
Yeah.
That's great in sport. That's not cool in police work.
Right.
Because you may have a dog that's on a down and you got a suspect that's being non-compliant, all of a sudden he goes compliant. And you're holding the dog and the officers are starting to approach, and all of a sudden he goes non-compliant again, but it doesn't raise to the level of letting your dog bite him. But the dog sees that movement from a stationary to the movement and goes, oh, I know this picture, and jumps out and bites the guy.
Right.
So I teach the dog, and the monkey understands the repetition association of hearing it 1,000 times and me putting the e-collar on them instead of the dog.
Yeah.
That until I tell you the bite command, I don't care what that guy's doing. He can be doing jumping jacks. He can be cooking breakfast. He can come up and actually pet you. If you look at my Instagram, I have pictures of me in a full bite suit petting dogs. Mm-hmm. They're on it down, and they're looking at me, and they're looking at their dad going, Dad, do you see what Daryl's doing?
Right.
Daryl's touching me. Why aren't you letting me kill Daryl?
Yeah.
But after I pet them, they understand, okay, you're not allowed to bite until Dad says it's okay. Then I stand up, and perfectly still, I don't move, give him the bite command. And the second he says the fuh of Foss, dog's on me like white on rice, because the dog understands it.
Yep.
These are the rules, which leads into a lot of problems we have, our passive prone suspects. Guys say, hey, you know, my dog won't engage the guy because he was passive prone. That's because you haven't taught the dog a bite command isn't a release to go chase the rabbit. It is a obedience command to wherever I'm telling you, put your mouth on that object.
Yeah.
So if it's a passive prone guy that we've just shot and he's laying on a gun and we need to do a dead check with long line, do you have the same technology of dead checks? For the guys that don't, you get an officer while shooting, the guy falls on a gun, you're behind cover, you put a long line on the dog, you send the dog up to grab the guy. To first of all, make sure he's not playing possum trying to ambush you. Number two, you pull the guy away from the weapon so your team can safely move up with some distance.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys have problems with that because, especially guys that have been shot and are probably dead, they haven't trained that. I tell my guys, teach the dog, when I say FOSS, I don't care if I'm pointing at a mannequin. I don't care if I'm pointing at a fire hose. I don't care if I'm pointing at a man. If I say FOSS, that means go put your mouth on
that's right.
That and bring it back to me.
Well, and to take that,
I got off on a tangent there.
No. It was a good tangent because it made me think about when I ran my kennels and I trained police dogs, or well, even personal protection dogs. I remembered the words of Terry Fleck. Terry was one of our instructors with another company that I resigned from. This was before Terry passed away, but I had an opportunity to talk to him quite a bit about case law and even false bite case law. Like, is a drunk person stumbling around, does that warrant the dog to attack them if they trip and fall because they're drunk? No. Okay, right. Is the guy guilty of public intox? Sure. But that doesn't warrant getting tased or a bite because there hasn't been any conflict yet.
Right.
The guy's just stumbling around. So, you know, we get into this rigmarole of this is how a decoy behaves. And we train them with these tight parameters. And these decoys do the exact same shit over and over and over again. And they're not thinking outside the box. So I said, what does a drunk guy look like then? I don't know, because, like, you know, if I'm two sheets to the wind, I don't see myself. I don't have a mirror. No one's filming me. So I got on YouTube and I started studying the body movement and the sway and how
they told me all you had to do is call me last night. I'll put you on video. You just see.
But you know what I mean?
That's another chance. So if you'd like, you know, video me later. I'm sorry, bro. You got on YouTube and were watching these videos.
Yeah, I started studying how a drunk person actually stumbles and falls. What are the different ways? And I begin to incorporate that into my decoy work and then have the handler correct the dog. When the dog has the urge to lunge and bite because I stumble within 3 feet of the handler, that doesn't give the dog permission to bite.
Right.
You know, so I completely agree with what you're saying. Or like you've seen the people on bath salts, the way they work, they look like they're dancing a jig sometimes, but that doesn't mean that it warrants an attack from the dog.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
You need to assess the situation as the more intelligent species. You're supposed to say, hey, what's up? You recognize they're not in their right mind. You put a hand on them. If they're not resisting and you know that it's because they're not in their right mind, they can't hear me, and you could easily grab the other hand, it doesn't warrant a bite.
Or beating him with a baton or a taser, which I try to tell guys, yeah, if I can't beat him with a baton, I can't bite him.
Right.
It's pretty simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about the intentions of the person's heart, really.
Yeah.
You know, are they just stoned out of their mind and that's why they're not complying, but yet they're not a danger to me? Then I could probably handle this with my two hands. Now, if they look at you with the intent of doing harm, then that's a whole different ballgame. And I know we're going down the rabbit hole of case law and all the work, but I just think that that's a valid topic to talk about. And I think that that needs to be incorporated in people's training.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
do these other things, give that exposure to the dog and let them know the rules of the obedience in bite work. Because
I agree. We have a lot of times with all these SWAT dogs, like in my SWAT canine course, a lot of these dogs, when they've seen, because I mean, training times are a premium. So the only time they've ever had the armor and all the SWAT guys kitted up and them sitting out there, they've always gotten a bite. They've never seen the guy come out and peacefully surrender and no bite. So these guys are training their dogs, repetition association, I need to bite somebody. So when the guy does surrender on the Channel 5 News live at 5, and he walks by the canine guy, the dog's losing his mind. He goes, well, if I can't bite him, maybe I'll displace frustration on you or one of the tack guys or something else. You've got to teach the guys, you got to teach the dogs, hey, sometimes they surrender. I actually made the mistake. 2 years ago, we had a officer involved shooting. This guy had killed a Pomona cop. He was barricaded in his apartment. Long story short, 18 hours later, we decided to do an explosive breach. I was set up ready for the explosive breach, and we've always taught our dogs gunfire neutrality, flashbang neutrality, gas gun. It doesn't matter. It's like birds singing and the sun shining. It doesn't mean you get a bite. We had never taught them explosive breach neutrality, and it bit me in the ass literally. I'm ready for the explosive breach. I'm set up. We're ready to go. The breach goes. It was a failed breach. So we have the big concussion, the noise, my dog's losing his mind. I got two operators in front of me, two behind me. We're in really tight quarters. And the dog's like, why aren't you letting me go? Because every time I've had that noise, I've always been released and got a bite. So I'm correcting him and yelling and screaming, which is, I don't understand, but SWAT guys get really mad when you start screaming and yelling and giving away their stealth position. I don't understand. I'm like, hey, we've been here 18 hours. They know we're here. They weren't happy that I'm screaming, fooey off, and in the background, I hear one of my old canine guys going, how many times are you going to tell them to lay down? There must be an echo in here. But yeah, shut up, asshole. I'm going to tell him off until he does it. So long story short, which I know it's already a long story, they set up a secondary breach, throw another charge on, boom, and it goes again, another failure to breach. So we're stuck, and my dog goes, all right, enough of this. And through frustrated displacement, grabs me. Now, this is a dog that I've been with for 3 years, and he's an 85-pound rock star. And he knew better because as soon as he did it, he was like, oops, sorry, Dad. No, that bridge has been crossed. So we had a little discussion.
Yeah.
Live at 5 with some SWAT guys there and everything else. But we had our little training session because you do not put your mouth on Dad or anyone else around. But the whole point of it is we had never taught the dog. And this is a rock star dog, Brian. I mean, this dog is the best police dog I've ever had. He's sitting in my kennel right now. He's a rock star. He had never been taught an explosive breach neutrality.
Yep.
So it wasn't his fault. That was my fault. That was our fault. I can't get mad at the dog. Now I can correct him for biting me because yeah, that's the world we live in. You don't put your mouth on Dad. I don't care. And there's a consequence to all kinds of things in life. Mm-hmm. But that was a mistake I had made. And after all these years of making that mistake, I went back to my unit and went, hey guys, I'm the first one to admit, hey, I screwed this up. Right. We need to go back and teach these dogs. Just because you hear the explosive breach doesn't mean, because we don't get that many training opportunities to do explosive breaches. So it's always a bite. Well, no, we got to change that.
Yep. And so, I'm really glad that you shared that story with me and everybody else, because that proves the point of those embodied cognitions, the experiences. If the dog, just like us, if they don't have the experience, they don't know how to behave. So then they choose what is common.
Right.
And if doing bite work after loud, crazy chaos, then that's what they're going to tap into.
Yep.
So absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I got to tell you, Daryl, man, this has been an amazing conversation. I think we touched on a lot of good points that other handlers around the country can soak in and think about as they formulate their training plan. So I really can't thank you enough for sharing your experiences with us and your point of view.
Absolutely.
I really like that, even with my description of the correction, you got it and you're doing it. You might not know all the science behind it.
I'll be honest, I can't say them big words.
Well, 90% of the trainers that I do talk to that are doing things right, they don't know that they're actually doing what's been proven scientifically. They just don't
know. Oh, yeah. That's when you and I talked before. I'm like, yeah, I do that, but I don't know why. It just, right. It's like spaghetti against the wall. It didn't stick, so it's time to eat.
Yeah. Well, even the guys at Working Dog Radio, when they interviewed me, Ted was like, you're right. I tell guys all the time. They're like, well, why does it work? He goes, I don't know. Just do it.
Yeah.
It does work. And I feel like for me, it's just time. It's time for trainers and handlers to start understanding the proven science, not to go against anybody and not to discredit anybody. If anything, it's to build confidence in what you're already doing.
Oh, absolutely.
Why it works. So go with confidence. That's what my goal is. I sold my kennels because I wanted out of the rat race of, you know, just handling dogs all the time because I was so intrigued by, oh my God. And sometimes it was, oh my God, I've been wrong this entire time. I've been teaching people for the last
time. Oh my God. It's hilarious you say that. The guy that I stole most of my stuff from, Brad Gillespie's Canadian, worked with their version of SEAL 6 up there. Mm-hmm. He's went back to Ottawa and he's a copper up in Ottawa. And great dog handler. I steal from him all the time. I give him credit, but I don't give him full credit. But he is the one that started this whole belief system I have that I'm teaching now for the last 10 years. And when he said some of the stuff he did and some of the stuff that I say in my class, and handlers look at me and they go, I have been beating dogs for the wrong reason for so long. I go, yeah, dude, I felt so guilty.
Yeah.
For 25 years, I've been abusing dogs basically because I let them get away with this today. I let them get away with that tomorrow. But Friday, I kicked their ass for doing the same thing. And they're like, whoa, Dad, you let me get away with that yesterday. Now you're beating my ass. And I felt so bad because I didn't have the consistency that we were talking about.
Right.
Brad explained it to me. I'm like, oh yeah, I do that all the time.
Yeah.
It's like teaching the out when guys, they'll give the dog the bite and they'll tell the dog to out and he won't. And he runs up to the decoy. Oh, sorry, bro. And he strong out the dog, comes back. Let me try that again. Sends the dog, bite. Oh, dog's like, no. Oh, sorry, bro. And he strong out the dog. He sends over the third time. Well, now the dog's starting to get tired. So when he says out, dog goes, huh, and let's go. What's the first thing they do? They grab the dog and go, yay, winner, and go put the dog in the car.
Right.
All you taught that dog is, If I don't let go, I get a bite again. So I get my reward a second time and a third time. If I do what you say and I let go, I get put in the car without a reward.
That's right.
And all my handlers go, oh, I did that yesterday. I go, I know, we all did. I don't stand up here and go, oh, I'm perfect. I screwed shit up for a long time. I'm still screwing shit up.
Yeah.
But when I explain it to guys like that, they go, holy crap, that makes sense. I go, yeah, we're teaching our dog not to let go.
Right. I think we're going to have to do a two-part series to this video because I have something else I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
Okay, so you just brought up another good topic. This is why I love science so much, because why do we correct our dogs? Like your whole, what you just described is right on. But okay, so why do we correct and why do we do things as the human the way that we do them? It's because we believe that's what we're supposed to do. The question is, what if we're wrong?
Yeah.
For example, we anthropomorphize the dog. Anthropomorphism is when we project human emotions onto objects and things. So for an example, if a dog looks at you and they chewed on the coffee table, and they look at you out the corner of their eyes and the ears drop back and they get real low to the ground, that's when we say, you knew what you did was wrong.
Yep.
Science has proven that to admit wrongdoing takes a higher level of reasoning and judgment. Specifically, Alexandra Horwitz from Barnard College in New York did a big study on this. And she said, this isn't the dog. Dogs don't have the ability to admit wrongdoing. This is not the guilty look. This is based on the response in the body language of the owner.
Absolutely. 1,000%. And that's a whole section in my lectures.
Yeah.
Is the dog pooping in the house. You come home an hour later, you smell poop in the house. You're like, God bless it. And you start stomping around looking for this damn dog.
Yep.
Dogs are excellent body language readers. 90% of dogs communicate through body language.
Okay.
They communicate to each other. So when he sees you come around the corner going, there he is, all of a sudden you're going to go, whoa, shit, I don't know what I did, but I'm getting my ass handed to me. Yeah. Well, yeah, I see he's guilty. No, he's not. Dogs can't feel guilt. I agree with you 1,000%. It's all, you're pissed off because you see something. The second you see it, your whole face changes, your body changes, your demeanor changes. Now you look at the dog and the dog goes, I don't know what's going on, but that's not a good body posture. That's not a good look, and something bad's going to happen.
Yep. Please don't take it out on me.
Yeah. No, I agree 1,000%. That's why it was funny when you said that, because that's how I have a whole thing when people are like, oh, yeah, he knew he was wrong. No.
That's like, right there is based on the human belief that this is truth. If the dog looks like that, now where do they get the idea that the dog is admitting wrongdoing? Because that's similar body language from what we see in little children.
Yeah, from a human, not a dog,
on the cookie jar, they lie, what do? They slump their shoulders forward, they deflate, they look at you out the corner of the eye, they'll put their hands in their pockets or kick a pebble, and that reminds us of that, so then we put that human emotion on the dog.
Absolutely.
Because we believe it to be true, we discipline the dog, but the dog is not making the connection between the discipline and pooping on the floor.
Right. No, not at all. All they know is, dad's kicking my ass. Well, I was scratching my ear 10 seconds ago, so maybe I'm getting my ass kicked for scratching my ear. Yeah. No, same thing when I tell guys, when we're doing distracted obedience for the e-collar, I'm pairing the e-collar, I'll have their toy, the dog's toy, and I'll be like right in front of them, like waving it and playing with it and throwing it. And if the dog breaks from his obedience routine, he gets a correction. If he stays with his obedience routine, he gets paid. Then we step it up with a bite sleeve or bite suit or whatever else. We eventually get down to the point where I'm petting the dog like I talked about. Mm-hmm. In my videos, there's a dog who tries to bite me and gets corrected on a down for biting me. And everyone goes, yeah, well, you corrected him. And I asked the question, why did I correct him? Well, he bit you. No, look at his chest. To bite me, he has to lift his chest off the ground. His command was down. Down is with your chest on the ground. I'm correcting them for breaking the obedience position of down, not for trying to bite me.
Right.
But guys don't understand that because they anthropomorphize. They're like, oh, he had an impure thought. He was trying to bite you. No, I don't care what his thought was. For whatever reason, I don't care. As long as your chest doesn't come off the ground, if I'm stupid enough to get my hand close enough where you can bite it, take it. But if your chest comes off the ground, I'm going to hurt you. and I break it down to the most simplistic terms like that. It's all black and white. And then guys start understanding it, and they start understanding, that's why I don't do preparatory commands and all this other stuff. You get one command and you follow that command until I either give you a release or another command. And guys tell me, well, I don't need to be that you know, consistent on it. I go, do you have a cage at home, a kennel? Well, of course I do. You said your dog's obedient, right? Yeah. Well, why can't you tell the dog to lay down at 8 o'clock at night in a place, go in, have dinner, go to bed, wake up at 6 o'clock. He better be in the same place because you told him to lay down. Well, that's being, you know, unreasonable. No. If you don't, now obviously it's facetious. We aren't going to sit a dog for 8 hours, but the point is, if you have that mentality, guys will lay their dog down and they'll go to do something in their car and the dog will get up and they'll say, okay, buddy, follow. Whoa, wait a minute. You allowed him to break the down. I know you wanted him to follow you after you got your leash out of the car, but he broke the down and you didn't correct him for it.
Right.
You just missed a beautiful opportunity. So when I get to the point of the training, I tell guys, I'll have this maniacal laugh, like, because the dog understands exactly what he's supposed to do.
That's right.
Now you're correctable, pal. Yep. Once I get you to 70%, is my belief, 70% of the time you're doing it when I ask you to, through reinforcements. Now you're correctable. That's when I get that laugh, because now the piper can be paid. That's now right. You're being, you know, disobedient to the point where I can use that punishment and make sure you do it. And the more consistent you are, and I tell guys, you follow this program religiously and consistently, you will correct your dog so much less, because 95% of the time they're going to be obedient, because they know dogs aren't stupid. If I'm not obedient, dad's going to hurt me. If I'm obedient, dad's going to love me. Let's see, hard way, easy way. Let me take the easy way. Let me not get my ass kicked. Now, 5% is always there because they're dogs.
Right.
Butterflies come out, shiny objects.
Yeah.
Females in heat show up.
Yeah. It's interesting, because it's not often that I talk to another trainer that has almost identical beliefs on how to train a dog.
Well, that's what you paid me the $40 for before we started, right? The check's in the mail, right?
You're right. Yeah. It's Monopoly money, though. Use it well. I do want to share with the civilian pet dog people that are going to see this video, when Daryl talks about hammering on the dog or kicking the dog's ass or whatnot, he's not saying that literal. That's police military lingo. What he's saying, to clarify, so nobody thinks that Daryl or myself is abusing dogs, we're saying that there's only one way to modify behavior. Treats and positive reinforcers cannot change pre-existing behavior.
No.
Only consequences that are unpleasant can change behavior. And that's what he's saying. Daryl has balance. He would not be in business if he didn't have balance. If he was just beating the snot out of dogs, that's gonna kill a dog's psychology. And he even talked about it earlier. Dogs redirecting, saying, hey, that wasn't fair. So
yeah.
I want to make that very clear to you, non-military and police dog people. What Daryl's simply talking about, that's just work lingo for, meaning I have to correct the dog in order to shape the behavior. We can't have the dog doing this because other people are in danger if the dog's not listening to the handler.
So absolutely. Perfect point.
I throw that disclosure out there.
Oh, absolutely. And thanks for clearing it up. It's just like when I was talking about the SWAT team, when we're correcting them, we're not dropping off the atomic elbow off the top rope. We're just barely tapping the dog on the back shoulders, but it's a physical. So my definition of a correction is a physical application for disobedience, whatever that physical application is, but it's gotta be a physical application. If you yell fooey at the dog and he corrects his behavior, he still needs a physical application of force. That doesn't have to be, you know, a stick across the back of the head with a 2x4. It can be so much as like, as much as I love and I hate Cesar Millan, his little pinch with that noise is actually, that's a marker and physical application of force, which is perfect. Everyone goes, oh, yeah, it's bullshit. He's actually a really good entertainer. He actually, his first kennel was in the area that I used to patrol in South Central.
Really?
Yeah. So yeah, and I use him as an example all the time because I'm big on markers. You have to mark it with phooey. But if you say the phooey, if you use the F word, not the other F word that I'm very, that I use like a comma sometimes when I'm not on social media. If you use the F word, the phooey word, you better correct that dog physically somehow. I don't care if that's even just a little flick behind the head. Mm-hmm. But the dog understands and went, okay, Dad, yeah, I love. Thanks for telling me you love me. Because if you don't correct the dog, he knows in his world he was supposed to be corrected for it. And if you don't, it, like I said, it shaves a little bit of that leadership off. It also makes him start to think, wait, maybe Dad isn't my protector. He's not my alpha. He's not my my pack leader because he didn't do what he's supposed to do.
Right.
And that's my belief. So yeah, when we talk about correcting dogs, it's not, you know, like I said, a Louisville slugger behind the head. If you, with my group, if I catch you abusing a dog, you and I are going to have some serious issues because it's not fair to the dog.
That's right.
And that's what I talk about. I don't correct dogs and muzzles unless I have to. I don't believe in e-collaring a dog from behind, you know, a fence or a long line. Now, I will double line dogs that for safety,
sure.
But I'll also pop those long lines off a minute later, and that dog's now off leash next to me with no muzzle.
Right.
So that's the honesty and the fairness that I believe I show the dog, and I get that reciprocal. And maybe it's anthropomorphism, maybe not, but I believe it's a mentality of the dog of he knows he can bite me. Like I said, that when the dog's laying down and I smack him, he looks at me and goes, "You know I'm off leash, right? You know I can bite you? Yeah, I know. I know there's all kinds of consequences to life. There's another consequence if you bite me. if it was a fair correction, you bite me, there's another consequence coming."
Right.
But I have that trust that I put in the dog, and I believe the dog gives me that trust back. And that's...
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, you talked about a physical punisher. I consider that, and that fits within my personal definition of a correction. It's a stimulus greater than what they're focused on. It's no different than us watching a movie or reading a book or a newspaper, and your husband or wife starts talking to you, and you hear them talking, but you can't make sense of what they said. Well, what would snap that out of you if they come up and they hit you? Hey, then you're like, oh, what? I was just talking to you for 30 minutes. You didn't hear anything that I said? No, but I can tell you about the book that I was reading. You know, but it took that neurological stimulation. That was a greater stimulus than the book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those neurological stimulations, that's part of what makes us mammals, because it's all about survival. And so, like, if I'm talking to you and I'm sharing an in-depth story of something that happened and somebody comes up behind me and pokes me in the ribs, guess what I'm not going to be doing in a split second? I'm not going to be having a conversation with you.
Right.
I'm going to turn to acknowledge what caused that neurological stimulation. So, yeah, everything that you're saying is supported by the psychology. So
the scientific voodoo.
Absolutely, yes. But that's why I love the scientific voodoo, because it lets us know that, no, there is validity to this.
Oh,
and all of those people that are watching this that they want to say, I don't care what they say, I don't agree. Well, okay, so that means that you're not agreeing with things that have been scientifically proven to be this way. It's in our nature to be this way. So in other words, what you're saying is I have closed ears and I just want to be right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we have trainers, we have civilians, we have handlers that are in fact that way. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. It's true.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree. Well, most times, you know, the only thing two trainers can agree on, right?
That the third trainer is wrong.
Third one screwed up. Yeah. How bad he is. Yeah. I'd never do that with my dog. Jeez, man, that guy's an idiot.
I hear that all the time, which is, and that's exactly why I'm doing these videos, is to open people's minds, just like in the movie The Matrix. In fact, there's a lot of neuroscientists that say that, you know, the movie The Matrix, it's not a movie, it's a documentary.
Oh, okay.
Because literally how we believe shapes our reality within our environment.
Oh, absolutely. You
know? Yes. So yeah, if you want to be closed-minded, then fine. You're just going to be an average handler. But if you really want to make a difference, you need to open your mind to different techniques. There's not one technique that's right. And the other thing, I got to be honest with you, Daryl, one of the things that I hate is when somebody takes old science and makes it their own. But then think, well, I invented this new system. No, yeah. Nobody invented anything new. This is stuff that scientists, not trainers, this is stuff that scientists have come out with over the last few hundred years to say, this is how we perceive our world. And when we have a perception, then it modifies our belief, which modifies our behaviors. Like, that's all of training and what it is. So no one's invented anything new, but they put their little spin on it. And then
they put
a name and they're like, well, it's my dog training system. Well, how did the Romans back in the day, one Roman soldier would have 8 to 10 mastiff looking dogs, these war dogs, and each one weighed over 100 and 120 pounds.
Yep.
How did they maintain control?
This was, you say that, because I was just going to bring up the Legionnaires. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did they do it back then? It's because nothing that we do now is anything new. The only thing that we are trying to do is create a greater understanding for the person who has to take over. Right. So you as the trainer, you've got to make them understand. That's where there's the difference, is how you're presenting the information, which is why for me, I ended up selling my kennel, and that's all I want to do is focus on helping people understand what trainers like you are trying to do and the information that's in their head. And it sounds like your class is right on, man.
I have a blast teaching it, and I'm really, really blessed. I have a core group of guys. I got Mike Goosby, who's the head trainer of LAPD, is, you know, my neighbor right here. We talk to each other all the time. I got Romeo Ingresso, who's one of our original guys that helped me with the, he's a sheriff and has a company with Ernie Wolowitz from Long Beach. I got guys in Mesa, Scott Callender, some of these other guys that there's this core group of guys. When you say, you know, no one invented anything. I 24/7, my phone number, if you want to put it up on, it's on my website anyway, that's my cell phone. People get surprised because they'll call me and I'll answer it. They're like, oh, I thought this was like a business, like a, you know, an answering machine. No, this is my cell phone, dude. I put it out there. I'm putting it out there right now. Anybody has any questions 24/7, if you're under a problem, you want an answer, I might not be right, but it's what I think. Mm-hmm. And if you hit me with a problem, I'm like, damn, I don't know. Let me get back to you. I'll call these guys. Hey, have you ever had this problem? What do you think? What do you do? Because I can't give you all the answers. There's absolutely no way. But my wife laughs, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night, my phone ring. Yeah. Yeah. What's up? Yeah. Okay. Okay. That happened. Okay. Here, try this. If it doesn't work, call me right back. All right, bro. All right, man. Yeah. Be safe. All right, cool. Bye. Click. My wife goes, who was that? I go, I have no idea. Judging by the time zone, I'm thinking maybe an East Coaster, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But that's the way I am. And I want to make sure, you know, anyone watching, you know, call me if you have a question or if you run into something and something works really well, let me know, because I'll call on my own and I'll make money off it. Hell, you know, put it the Daryl Gaughan training method. Oh, I learned this. But well, yeah, so I'm really lucky to have that core group of guys that have a ton of knowledge and make me look good, because I get back to the person and go, hey, this is what so-and-so said. Try it. If it doesn't work, blame them. If it does work, I'll take the credit.
Well, what I'll do, Daryl, is I'm going to put your website information above.
Okay.
And also your phone number, so other handlers can reach out to you if they do have questions, if they want to pick your brain a little bit.
Absolutely.
Man, I can't thank you enough for this. Has been an awesome conversation. I think we've touched on, you know, we went from just really talking about obedience and behavior to all sorts of different things. So this has been awesome. I really appreciate your time. I think you're doing some great work out there in California. Keep up the good work, my friend.
Yeah, no, thanks, man. Like I said, give me an excuse to talk about dogs, I'll talk your ear off. So great, and thanks for doing the stuff you're doing. Cause like I said, once you and I talked, when I first saw some of your stuff, I'm like, well, I do that. Well, now I know why I do it. Oh, okay, cool. That's awesome. So yeah, no, it helps to have, like you said, the background behind it to say, hey, there's some foundation to why we're doing it, not just throwing it against the wall, making it stick.
You got it, man. You got it, brother.
So, awesome.
Daryl, thanks again, brother. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
All right.